This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan. Welcome to the first episode of season 11. How incredible does that sound?
It's mad, isn't it? Welcome back, everyone. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for your patience whilst you awaited our return. It was only a week or two, though, wasn't it, Bethan?
It was, but it felt like ages to me. I feel like we haven't done this. I think I've forgotten how to talk.
It is weird, isn't it? Yeah. And also we're recording at night, which is rare for us.
It's always a bit weirder.
It's really weird. And it's Sunday night. So I've got proper Sunday syndrome, but I am drinking a glass of Chardonnay. So, you know, it could be worse. And I can't really do that on a Sunday morning when we normally record.
You could, but you probably shouldn't. Yeah, I'm saving my glass of, I've got some fizz because it's Mother's Day. I've got some fizz waiting for me downstairs. So when we finish, I'll be pouring a glass. I'm not going to drink while we're recording though.
Oh, okay.
It will descend by the end.
It's my case this week. So there's a lot of reading from me. So we'll see how that goes.
I'm glad that you have changed your idea because anybody who's on our social media will have seen. But if people listened to the last episode of last series, so our most recent episode, they may be expecting something a bit different this week. And I'm really glad that you've changed your mind.
Yeah, so I can't even remember his name, but he's the guy from Australia that he basically was sexually abusing lots and lots of dogs. One of the worst cases of bestiality that has ever occurred, I guess. And it is fascinating, but it is just harrowing. And I started looking at it, I was like, I can't do it. So I'm glad that I decided not to.
I can't even bring myself to Google who he is or what he's done. But a few of our listeners have seen you say you're not going to cover him, Googled him, and then be like, for God's sake, I've now Googled him and I don't want to have known.
Yeah, it's the most depraved stuff I've ever come across.
Oh, gosh.
And we've covered seriously sick shit on this show. So yeah, you're right, Bethan, to mention that because I did mention it at the end of our season 10 finale. So no, we are not heading to Australia for our season 11 premiere. We are heading to the Scottish Highlands. And it's a case that we did mention briefly on an episode of Crime Wave last year, which is our Patreon exclusive podcast. So we're going to delve into it in all of its detail. But before we do that, let's take a moment to thank our most recent Patreon supporters. Shall we tag team, Betham?
Oh, yes, let's do it.
Okay, so we have Natasha Absalon.
Lauren.
Sarah Taylor.
Angelica Garpland-Seedorf.
Zoe Lee Thacker.
Lucy Pawson.
Jamie Holt.
James Ball.
Kira Matthews.
Andrew Richard Hope.
Imogen C.
Charlene Galloway. Oh, Galloway. I don't know why I couldn't say the name Galloway then. Charlene Galloway.
Elaine Hamilton.
Lily Holland.
Helen Laura Jordan.
Winnie.
Janine Cordill.
Oh my gosh, we're terrible. Janine Cordill and Claire. Thank you so much, everybody.
And we've just had one come through. That's Reese Kershaw as we are recording. So thank you to Reese Kershaw as well.
Oh, hot off the press. Thank you, Reese.
Thank you, each and every one of you. And of course, thanks to all of our existing Patreon supporters too. If you would like to join these people, all you need to do is head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast. Only takes a couple of minutes to sign up. And for your support of the show, there is so much to reward you with over there. So do check it out. Our story this week, as I said, takes us to the Scottish Highlands. The Highlands is an historical region of Scotland, characterised by its mountainous terrain and its beautiful scenery. Unlike its neighbouring lowlands, it is sparsely populated, rural and remote. The Highlands encompasses roughly 11,000 square miles of western Scotland and includes Ben Nevis, the highest mountain range in the British Isles. It's a truly stunning part of the world, but its remoteness and also the weather conditions that plague its rugged landscape bring a sense of foreboding. And I am perhaps being a little bit dramatic here, but there is this kind of haunting quality to the Scottish Highlands, isn't there, Betham?
There is, and I think there's a lot of the UK that's like that, because when we have our cities or even our big towns, it's so populated and you're constantly near somebody. And so it's, even though we're such a small country and we're such a small island in general, the British Isles, it's just always mad to know that we have places like this that are, you know, dangerously remote. If you're not a hiker with experience, you could come into a lot of risky situations. And it is really odd when you think of some of the really populated cities in Scotland, and then you've got the Highlands. It's just mad.
Yeah, you're right. There are so many regions like this in the UK, and the Yorkshire Moors is another one that springs to mind. And of course, there is that awful history associated with that. But I think with the Scottish Highlands, you've got the echoes and the memories of battles fought and lost over the centuries. And I don't know, it's just a weird, haunting place. Maybe not everybody would agree with that, but I feel that it is.
I know what you mean as well, because when we think of, like you said, the history around the Yorkshire Moors, for example, and people whose remains have never been found, that sort of thing, it is just so vast. And how would you ever be able to search and find people? So, yeah, I'm sure there's similar sort of tales or instances of people in the Scottish Highlands where potentially we'll never know where somebody is or their last resting place. And that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, I think that's it, actually. When now you've said that, I think that's what it is, that it is the final resting place for lots of people. And because of the remoteness, in the same way as the Yorkshire Moors, those people's remains aren't recovered and they don't have a proper final resting place. Just a kind of tortured one. So maybe it is to do with that. And I wanted to set the scene quite vividly there, because when we think of Scotland, you're kind of right, Beth, and you've alluded to this. It is a country of two halves, really. You've got the urban lowlands, a flat industrial region encompassing the likes of Glasgow and Edinburgh. And then you have the Highlands, which couldn't be more different, really. It's haunting, as we've said. It's remote, mountainous, vast. This is unspoilt land that hasn't changed in millennia. According to the charity Missing People, nearly 15,000 missing persons reports are made to Police Scotland every year. Of these 15,000 reports, the vast majority, over 99%, result in the safe return of a missing person. Very sadly, however, a small proportion of the people reported missing each year never return, having come to significant harm, either at their own hand or at the hand of somebody else. We know, of course, that people go missing for a variety of reasons. We've spoken about it many times on the show before. They may be struggling to cope with various aspects of their lives and see running away as a way of solving their problems. They may be a victim of domestic abuse, or indeed they may have committed a crime themselves and go missing in a bid to evade the law. Most people who do go missing are located very quickly. But what of those who are never located? Those who are frozen in time and forever missing. People like Claudia Lawrence, whose father recently went to his grave not knowing the fate of his beloved daughter. And of course, we covered that case very early on, didn't we? An incredibly frustrating missing persons case. And lots of theories. And yeah, and you talk about it in your book, don't you, Beth? And mm-hmm. In one of your chapters, and link her disappearance to Christopher Halliwell, which is totally mm-hmm. credible. But technically, it is unsolved, that case.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have Maddie McCann, perhaps the most high-profile unsolved missing persons case in this country, possibly even the world. The daily torture their families must endure is hard to imagine, because lives are on hold. False hopes and dashed hopes are a daily occurrence, and anniversaries and birthdays come and go. And it's just never-ending unanswered questions, I would imagine. It just doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
It really is just awful. And, you know, when you just don't know, I saw something on Facebook recently where there was a whole Facebook page looking for this person. And they then had to put a post up saying the police have been in touch and have said that the CCTV footage that we have been sharing and highlighted was definitively this person. And they have made it, like, this guy had made it really clear that he did not want anybody to know where he was, and he didn't want the police to continue looking for him, and he'd actually made contact with the police. So all of these people who were searching now had to kind of basically respect his wishes and take a step back from looking for him. But that, you know, that sort of thing, they at least knew he was alive, and they said, at least we know he is okay, but we want whatever's best, you know, whatever he needs, that's what he needs. But we're here for him when he wants to come back. And that was just so heartbreaking. But I sort of sat there and read it and I thought, gosh, at least they know.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, that's nearly as bad as an unsolved missing persons case where there is zero closure, because at least they do know that the person is hopefully safe, and yeah, they've just disappeared of their own volition. They don't want to come back. But that must also be incredibly hard to know that they have made a conscious decision to up and leave and walk away from everybody in their life and turn their back on them for very valid reasons, I'm sure. But yeah, for those people left behind, that must also just be so incredibly difficult. Not as difficult as this lack of closure, but still very tough.
It's just, yeah, it's awful to think of.
And these unsolved cases, that lack of closure and being frozen in time, that is a reality for many, many families. And that was the reality for the family of 63-year-old Tony Parsons, the subject of today's episode, a much-loved granddad who vanished without a trace in 2017 on a dark, wet night deep in the Scottish Highlands as he embarked on a solo charity bike ride. Tony Parsons was an adored granddad, dad and husband from Tillicoultrie, a town in Clackmannanshire in Scotland. He was a passionate fisherman and a keen golfer, and he loved nothing more than spending time with his grandchildren. Having previously undergone treatment for prostate cancer, Tony, a former submariner with the Navy, wanted to give something back. So, on the 29th of September in 2017, he set off on a 104-mile solo charity bike ride through the Scottish Highlands. As his family waved him off that day, they could never have anticipated that that would be the last they ever saw of him. For just hours later, Tony would seemingly vanish into thin air, leaving his devastated family searching for answers for 3 long years before the mystery of his disappearance would be solved with brutal clarity.
What a huge thing to do, but also, like, 104 miles solo.
Yeah.
That just would worry me anyway. Like, what if you came off your bike, or you had some sort of accident, or, you know, just needing support, as in, like, your tyre's gone flat or something. It's a really big thing to do. Like, fair play to him, because obviously it's for charity, but just seems really, really bonkers.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, he was a really sporty guy, very fit, and on a mission, you know, wanted to raise money and give something back. So
there
was
a real, admirable, isn't it?
Yeah, real motivation and determination on his part. But yeah, I think it's, you know, he's a bigger man than I am, because I'd never dream of doing something like this. And his plan was to do this bike ride through the night, so in pitch black.
God, that's even worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I once did a cycle that was about 16 to 20 miles. Wasn't that far compared with most people's long cycle rides. But my bicycle had broken, so I had 3 gears. So I kind of had to just be in the middle the whole way, and it was just awful. And then the cycle home wasn't part of the charity thing, but obviously how else are you going to get home?
Yeah.
And the other person that I'd cycled with, as we set off, she just went, do you mind if I just go ahead now and just get home? Because I was so slow. How embarrassing is that?
How harsh of them.
Well, I kind of get it, though. She just wanted to get home, didn't she?
Fuck her, Bethan.
So I just cycled home by myself.
Fun. This is why I don't do charity bike rides. So let's head back to that fateful day, the 29th of September in 2017. Having said goodbye to his family, Tony boarded a train to Fort William. The plan was for him to cycle the 104 miles from Fort William back to his home in Tillicoultrie. With rest stops along the way, it was anticipated that this would take a day or so. Now, it's quite a long train journey from Tillicoultrie to Fort William, even though it's only around 100 miles, but I don't think there are any direct trains. So by the time Tony sets off on this charity bike ride from Fort William, it's already getting late, and we know that Tony arrived at Fort William at around 5 p.m. as he texted his wife Margaret to say as much. So, yeah, I think he left home in the morning, but it's taken hours and hours to get to that start point for the bike ride.
And I kind of feel a bit sad that there's not people waving him off at the beginning.
Well, I think they waved him off as he got on the train.
Feel like you want somebody to like count you down and off you cycle. Of course, they're not going to. It's a long journey just to say goodbye and then get back on the train back home. And he doesn't sound like the type that needs a fanfare and parade. But I kind of, he's just like got off the train. He's like, right, I'll get cycling.
Yeah, it's a bit of an anticlimax, perhaps. Mm. But yeah, he would have soon got going. Evening was certainly drawing in. So approximately 40 miles and 6 hours later, around 11 p.m., Tony was spotted at the Bridge of Orkney Hotel, a pit stop along his cycle route back to Tillicoultrie. The weather wasn't great that night. In fact, it was pretty terrible, but Tony planned to cycle right through the night nevertheless after that brief stop for refreshments at the hotel bar at the Bridge of Orkney Hotel. So, of course, I mentioned before about the remoteness of the Highlands. It's a very popular tourist destination, so people do flock there, usually when the weather is better in the summer. But there are only 600,000 inhabitants across the whole 11,000 square miles that the Highlands encompasses. So you can go miles and miles and miles without seeing any kind of civilization. A bit like, I guess, the Australian outback, but on a smaller scale.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Many of the small villages that do exist in the Highlands have very few amenities. There just aren't enough people living in these locations year round to warrant pubs and restaurants, for example. So what you often get are hotels, small B&Bs, and they serve a dual purpose. They provide accommodation for tourists, of course, but they also serve as hubs for the communities in which they are located. So the Bridge of Orkney Hotel is the beating heart of the community in the village of Bridge of Orkney, which is a tiny village deep in the Highlands with a population of just 152 people.
Oh, wow. So you kind of need a pub, don't you? But at the same time, they may as well have like a B&B and the locals can still drink in the bar.
Yeah, a pub just wouldn't survive because it would be busy in the summer and that's kind of it. So yeah, it's quite normal to just have these B&Bs and they have bars and restaurants in them. And what it means is you often get a mix of tourists and locals in the hotel bars and restaurants. However, it is mostly locals when you're out of tourist season. So the end of September would have been not a school holiday. We're out of the summer holidays then. The weather's getting worse, so it would have mostly been locals that were in that bar on that night. Additionally, the 29th of September in 2017 was a Friday, so the bar at the Bridge of Orkney Hotel would have been packed that night, even at 11 o'clock when Tony arrived. As I said, in late September, it would have mainly been locals in there, and they'd have, I guess, been having a few drinks to celebrate the end of the working week. Tony kept himself to himself in the bar at the Bridge of Orkney Hotel that night. He chatted to the landlord briefly as he sipped his coffee and explained that he was nearly halfway through a 100-mile charity bike ride. He said he was planning on carrying on through the night with the aim of getting home first thing in the morning. And the landlord tried to talk Tony out of his plans owing to the poor weather that night and offered to book him a room, but Tony politely declined. He was on a mission. Had Tony taken the landlord up on his offer that night, in all probability, he would still be here.
Oh, that's... Oh, I hate it.
I hate that. Just a chance thing of...
Yeah.
You know, we don't know the thought process that went through Tony's mind when the landlord said, don't do it, it's terrible weather, we've got a spare room, we can book you in. He might have debated that and thought, oh, maybe I should, maybe that is the right thing to do. So it's almost on the flip of a coin, and there are catastrophic consequences to him not doing that. But equally, I completely understand this brave mission of his. He is on a mission, he's halfway through, and he wants to just power through and get home for the morning, thinking, you know, I've done this. This was a massive achievement and I've done it.
And did you say he'd been in the Navy, I think you said before?
He had, so yeah.
He'd been in the forces, like a bit of bad weather is probably nothing to him. He's probably like, do you know what? I'd rather be at home tomorrow.
I think this is it. You know, it's easy to judge it from my own perspective, which is I wouldn't dream of doing a charity bike ride because it's too much effort. I would definitely do other stuff for charity. We've done lots for charity, Bethan, when we work together in particular, and we still do it now on behalf of the podcast. But I would do it in other ways that don't involve as much physical exertion. And also, you know, yeah, he's old school. He's hard. You know, he's hard to this. Whereas I'd be too scared to embark on a bike ride through the Scottish Highlands in the pitch black. But yeah, he's probably done much scarier things before.
And I don't know what you're going to say actually happened to him, but it just sounds, yeah, if perhaps he wouldn't have come across a certain person on his route now or something like that. And that's just awful.
Yeah, it was, the stars aligned in absolutely the wrong way that night for Tony. After finishing his coffee, Tony headed out of the hotel and into the night, 60 miles or so left to go. He travelled south down the A82. And that was the last anyone saw of him. Tony never did arrive home the next day, or the day after that. And by the 2nd of October, with his family having already reported his disappearance to police, he was officially declared a missing person. A major missing persons investigation was launched, and Mountain Rescue, police and local volunteers desperately searched for Tony. Although the Highlands is a huge area, officers quickly ascertained that Tony had made it to the village of Bridge of Orkey, where he had stopped at the eponymous hotel. They presumably knew the route he would take from there and followed it, from the air and on the ground with tracker dogs. But there was no sign of him. Had he drifted off the main road and taken a shortcut in the early hours, perhaps? Or sought refuge from the weather in an abandoned cottage somewhere? Maybe he had an accident or become suddenly ill, incapacitated and unable to call for help. Or maybe he'd come to harm at the hands of somebody else, a lone psychopath roaming the Highlands looking for his next victim, perhaps. In those early days, no news was good news. There was still hope for Tony's family, and there was no way they were going to give up on the search for him. But days soon turned to weeks, and weeks to months, with still no news. Police continued to investigate Tony's disappearance. They released CCTV footage of his last known movement and sporadically appealed for information. Tony's son Mark also made an appeal on BBC's Crime Watch in 2018. Now, I don't know exactly when the Crime Watch appeal went out that year. I did try and find it so that I could watch it. So what follows may or may not have been as a result of the appeal. But in August of that same year, 2018, as the one-year anniversary of Tony's disappearance approached, police received an anonymous letter out of the blue naming two local men in connection with Tony's disappearance. The letter urged police to pay close attention to the men, saying they were at the Bridge of Orkey Hotel on the night Tony disappeared. This was a major development. Had these two men encountered Tony at the hotel bar? Perhaps there'd been a disagreement, some kind of argument that night, resulting in them attacking Tony. Maybe, just maybe, they had killed him and hidden his body deep in the remote countryside. After receiving the letter, the police bided their time. They quietly investigated the two men who had been named, twin brothers who were local to the area, and they eventually paid them a visit in January 2019.
That is just mad. Imagine receiving that letter and just being like, hang on a second, what? We've got to go look for this. I just can't imagine that.
Yeah, and it's, you might think, as, I mean, you know, the police largely know what they're doing. They might just be thinking, I'm sure it's legitimate to think, well, maybe that's just someone who's got a grudge against these two brothers and is looking to get them into some kind of trouble. and they're nothing to do with this. So this is an anonymous letter. They can't go and question the author of the letter. Yeah, it's just, it's kind of vague, but it's planting that seed that you need to pay attention to these two men. So the brothers, Alexander, or Sandy, as he was known to his friends, and Robert McKellar were in their mid-20s at the time of Tony's disappearance, and they both lived and work on the nearby Ork Estate, a 9,000-acre farm and estate which is a popular hunting destination for tourists. I tried to find out some more information about this estate because it does feature heavily in this story, but it was recently sold for £11 million, and it looks like the website isn't really functional anymore. But I think it's a typical Scottish Highlands estate, the sort of place city boys from London head to for a weekend of hunting, shooting and fishing, decked out in their finest country gentleman regalia. Think hunter wellies and barber jackets and you'll be on the right lines.
That sort of hunting.
That kind of hunting. And I'm not belittling it. I'm belittling hunting because I don't agree with that. But this estate would have absolutely been the real deal. But because of that, it would have attracted the types of people who enjoy cosplaying, being the country gent for a couple of days. So foreign tourists, but also, yeah, people that just want to be that country gent for a weekend and go hunting, shooting and fishing. So Alexander and Robert McKellar lived and worked on the estate. They were both described at the time as farm workers, and Alexander was also a deer stalker. And I think they both helped with guiding hunts and shoots and stuff like that. As I said, the police paid the brothers a visit in January 2019, a few months after receiving this anonymous letter. The police asked them if they had been involved in a road accident on the night of the 29th of September in 2017, but they were promptly told by Alexander and Robert to clear off, which they did. And to be fair, I guess all they had to go on was this letter that they'd received, which was, after all, anonymous. And all they wanted to do at this stage was to informally question the brothers. They had no evidence and no reason to arrest them, so when they were told to get lost by them, I guess, to be fair to the police, they had no choice but to do exactly that. Years now passed with no further news and no concrete leads. Tony's family were faced with the agonising reality of going to their graves not knowing what happened to him. And I know I mentioned it before, but this really is the cruelest aspect of any unsolved missing persons case. I'm sure Tony's family would have had many sleepless nights, lay there in the small hours, thinking through the different fates that may have befallen their beloved father, brother and husband. And that lack of closure must just be so unbelievably hard to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Because for them, life doesn't stop. That loved one is frozen in time, but you have to find a way to carry on, to continue working, providing for your family, showing up for your children, functioning. It must just be so incredibly hard to do that, though.
Yeah, you just can't even imagine how difficult that must be. And kind of torturing yourself of, well, the police have said to us that they had this lead, but then it went nowhere. Why did it go nowhere? Like you said, I get it. They have to just, they've got no reason to arrest anybody. They just wanted to speak to them. And if they don't want to speak to them, they don't want to speak to them. But I'm sure that the police would have said something to the family, you know, we've got this lead, we're looking into this, because you have to keep them kind of involved and informed. And then suddenly nothing's come of it. So you're just still left in that limbo of what happened. Is he still alive? Like, can we keep that hope? Can we not? Yeah, it's just awful.
And I think you will keep that hope, because until you know for certain the fate of that individual, so if a body is discovered, then obviously that's very difficult to deal with and there's still going to be lots of unanswered questions. But there is an element of closure then. But when no body is discovered, you will always have an element of you that defies logic and says that that person is still alive, that Tony set out on that bike ride and for some reason rode off and decided to live a life elsewhere away from his family and he's out there doing that. Even though that is unrealistic, that is going to be something that you torture yourself with. And equally, if you're accepting that he has come to some kind of harm, yeah, you're going to be thinking, was it prolonged? Was it an accident? Did he have a heart attack? Did somebody cause harm to him, which must just add a whole other level to this. In June 2020, 18 months after the police first attempted to quiz Alexander and Robert McKellar about their possible involvement in Tony's disappearance, they tried again. This time the brothers were more talkative and more candid. They confirmed they had indeed been at the Bridge of Orchy Hotel on the night in question, but they said they had not seen Tony Parsons. It was a step in the right direction, but still with no new leads, it looked as though Tony's disappearance would remain forever unsolved.
It just seems so weird, like, why are they... Oh, we'll admit that we were there then. Like, it just, I don't know, like, I just... Why wouldn't you speak before? And now you will, but you'll only say so much. Yeah, just frustrating.
Well, I guess, I mean, we don't know at this stage. Maybe the police had independent witnesses that verified that the brothers were there on that night, and the brothers were aware of that, so they kind of had to at least tell the truth as far as that was concerned. And then they're kind of categorically saying, we didn't have anything to do with this person's disappearance. We didn't see him that night. We were there. We're there most Friday nights or whatever, but this is nothing to do with us, thinking that will just kind of stop it dead. But then something major happened, actually. So just 6 months later, in December 2020, the police were approached by a woman called Caroline Muirhead. She said she had information about the disappearance of Tony Parsons, and finally, the mystery of Tony's disappearance was on the brink of being solved. Caroline was the girlfriend of Alexander McKellar. Having met on a dating app, they hadn't been together long by this point, just a few weeks, but already in that short space of time, Caroline had become suspicious of her boyfriend's behaviour. She was invested in the relationship and felt that it could go the distance, and I think actually Alexander had proposed to her at this point, just 5 weeks in, so he thought the same, but she definitely felt like he was holding something back. He was anxious, panicky at times, and things actually came to a head in November 2020 when Caroline and Alexander were out driving. A police car went past them in the opposite direction, and Caroline noticed Alexander become immediately tense at the sight of it. She asked him what was wrong, and he began to have a panic attack. When he calmed down, he was ready to unburden himself of a years-long secret that he had been keeping. Finally, the mystery of what happened on the fateful night of the 29th of September in 2017 was about to be solved once and for all.
Gosh, that must have been really awful. Like, it's interesting that she already knew that there was just something he was hiding or holding back. But can you imagine being in the car at that moment when someone is so tortured by whatever they're about to tell you, and you just, you'd be thinking, like, this is going to change everything. Whatever you're about to tell me is going to have massive ramifications for us, our relationship, for you, your life, our life. Just, you just have that knowledge, wouldn't you? You don't know what they're about to say, but something.
And I've not really, even though I've said that they were actually engaged, I think Alexander had proposed to Caroline just a few weeks in, I've not really done their relationship justice, because although it was in its infancy, it was incredibly serious, and Caroline was absolutely imagining spending the rest of her life with this man. And they were having a bit of a heart-to-heart in the car, and she was sort of wanting to push him, rightly so, along the lines of, look, you know, if we are going to be spending the rest of our lives together, you can't hold anything back from me. You can't keep any secrets. And I know that there's something that you're keeping from me, and you have got to tell me, and I will support you. That's what she said. I will support you with it. So I think he felt that it was a very safe space in which to unburden himself of this terrible secret that he'd been keeping, which we'll come on to exactly what happened. Alexander told Caroline how he and his brother Robert had been dining and drinking at the Bridge of Orchy Hotel that night with a German hunting party. It was a long night, and both Alexander and his brother Robert had been drinking heavily. At around midnight, Alexander and Robert jumped into their car, an Isuzu pickup truck, and with Alexander at the wheel, they made their way down the A82 towards their home on the Ock Estate, just a few miles away. And we'll pick things up in real time now. It's pitch black as the brothers make their way down the A82. Alexander has driven this route 1,000 times before, and he knows this road like the back of his hand. Good job, really, as the rain is lashing down on the windscreen, and he is feeling the effects of a long day and a drink-fueled night. Just minutes into their journey, the brothers' car violently jolts. A loud thud echoes in their ears. They've hit something. a deer perhaps. Whatever it is, it was heavy. Alexander pulls in at the side of the road and gets out of the car to inspect the damage. It's bad. He walks around the vehicle, and then to his absolute horror, he sees a severely injured man lying on the side of the road. The man, Tony Parsons, is still breathing. He's alive, but it's clear that he's very badly injured. A panicked Alexander returns to the car and explains what's happened to Robert. The brothers decide not to call the emergency services, and instead they come up with a plan.
Oh, I hate this so much because, yes, you've been drink driving and you don't know. You may have caused this person's death, and then you're going to be convicted of death by dangerous driving, and
yeah,
you've definitely broken the law here. But you know, you could also get this person to safety and they will survive if they, you know, whatever they're about to do is clearly going to be that stupid idea of we'll try and cover this up, which, and you know, for normal people, like you've just explained, it eats away at normal people, because actually you're not an evil person. You're a normal person who will be affected hugely. You're not going to get away with this. You're not going to not tell someone or confess. It was a horrible, horrible accident. But what you decide to do in that moment afterwards is what will really shape everything.
Yeah, and I hate to use this phrase, but I just think man the fuck up and own it and face the consequences. You have made a mistake. You have been speeding and drink driving and you have run somebody over, and you need to just, unfortunately it's happened and you need to do the right thing, but in a totally cowardice way, that's not what happens. And you know, they're not medical experts. They don't know exactly how badly Tony is injured, so they don't know that he is perhaps dying at this point, which actually he is. They could have administered basic first aid and maybe Tony's life could have been saved for all they knew, but they chose to do nothing. And yeah, they decide to leave Tony Parsons dying at the side of the road to continue their journey back home to the Ock estate, where they then dump their phones and change into a different vehicle, a Toyota, before making their way back to the scene of the hit and run. As they do that, Tony Parsons takes his last breath. He dies there at the side of that road, deep in the remote Scottish Highlands, all alone, with rain lashing down on him. And it is just, to say it's heartbreaking is a huge understatement, but that is one of the saddest elements to this case for me, that Tony died on his own, and they could have at least provided comfort to him in his dying moments, even though Tony would go on to die at their hand. They could have still provided comfort or tried to save his life, but they abandoned him, and Tony would have been alive for 20 to 30 minutes after he was hit by their car. Was he conscious? Did he know what had just happened? We don't know that, but there's a chance that he was conscious, that he knew what had happened, that he knew he'd been hit by a car, and that he then saw it going off in the distance, knowing that no one was coming for him to help him. When the brothers arrive back at the scene, they quickly ascertain that Tony has now died. They lift his body and his bicycle into the back of their car and drive back to the Ork estate, where they hide Tony's body and his bike in a wooded area while they decide what to do next. After a fitful night, Alexander and Robert wake to a full day. There won't be any time to properly dispose of Tony's body just now. A shooting party awaits the brothers' attendance and instruction. Nursing sore heads and perhaps attempting to conceal their fatigue from their shooting party of city boys, the brothers do their thing while quietly plotting their next move. Later that day, they move Tony's body from the hidden wooded area to a freshly dug grave in a peat bog on the estate, which is used as a burial site for animal carcasses. Because this is a massive 9,000 acre estate with all sorts of wild animals roaming on it. And these guys work there, other people work there. And part of the job is that animals are going to die continually, and they can't just be left out there in the wild. So their carcasses are moved using mechanical diggers and taken to this peat bog where they're buried. So this is, you know, a graveyard of animals from this estate. And Tony's body is now buried there with the help of a mechanical digger. After disposing of his bike behind a waterfall and burning his possessions, the two brothers have sufficiently covered their tracks in order to evade capture. For now, at least.
Oh, I mean, and a bit like I said before, if this was somebody who had chosen to take someone's life, you know, if this was that fanciful sort of serial killer from a novel,
yeah,
that was a, you know, potential, then this is a very sensible and clever way to dispose of a body, to dispose of the things that can link you with this. But yeah, this is a normal person. You're going to feel guilt and you're going to feel anxiety about what you did. Just, oh, I mean, you could have just called an ambulance at the time and faced your stupidity.
And it would have ended very differently. There would have been heartache for Tony Parsons' family, but less heartache because they would have at least known what happened to him and they wouldn't have had 3 years of unanswered questions.
Yeah. And then still to not have any, you know, him to bury and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine you'd have his remains if he was in somewhere like a peat bog, because surely that would really speed decomposition, and he's in with all the animals and stuff that I don't know, but that just seems, yeah. God, the whole thing is just so, so sad.
It is incredibly sad. And yeah, I think it's fair to talk about Alexander and Robert over the 3 years during which time they evaded capture. Because of course, yeah, Caroline, Alexander's girlfriend, does go to the police and report this. So spoiler alert, they do get caught, and I'll come on to all of that in a moment. But yeah, I think it's fair to look at Alexander and Robert in those 3 years, how life must have been for them. And I have no sympathy for them whatsoever, but I just think it's an interesting study of what they may have gone through in that time. That anxiety was obviously there. Those panic attacks evident with Alexander, a police car being a huge trigger for him. If he sees a police car, he's panicking and thinking this is it. So, you know, he was absolutely looking over his shoulder for those 3 years. However, he could have done the right thing and handed himself in, and he never did that. And he saw the media reports regarding the disappearance of Tony Parsons. He didn't know that the man he'd hit was Tony Parsons, but he knew that the media reports matched the description of the man that he had hit. So he put two and two together and thought, in all probability, that man was Tony Parsons, and I hold the key to this unsolved mystery for his family. And he did nothing. He did nothing other than unburden himself to someone he thought would keep his secret. So that was cowardly too.
I'm kind of glad that he was tortured for all that time.
100%.
Something,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. And yeah, I do think he thought it was a safe space in which to unburden himself. This was the woman he was planning to marry. But what Alexander can't have imagined is that Caroline, although only his girlfriend of a few weeks, would betray his trust in her. And she did so in sophisticated and spectacular fashion. Had she not, the mystery of Tony Parsons' disappearance would never have been solved, and his family would have lived out their days not knowing what had happened to him. Following Alexander's confession, Caroline, who just happened to be a forensic pathologist, spent a month gathering evidence before going to the police in December 2020. During a trip to the burial site shortly after Alexander had confessed to her, she had cleverly left a can of Red Bull there as a marker. When she went to the police, she was able to show them exactly where Tony Parsons was buried, because that can of Red Bull was still there.
Oh my gosh, what an incredible... Do you know what? You might hear something like that and panic or anything, but she's so calm and collected and just goes, right, I need to get the information so that I can properly go to the police with like full information for them. That's absolutely amazing.
I think she's thinking, you know, I've got one chance now to get justice for Tony's family. I have one chance to do that, and I need to not fuck it up. So I could go to the police right now following this confession, but actually there's going to be a greater chance of prosecution if I bide my time and coax more information out of Alexandra. And that's exactly what she did. And yeah, part of that was getting him to take her to the burial site, which was so important, because had he not done that, had she not got him to do that, and had she not had the foresight to leave a kind of Red Bull there, it is highly unlikely that Tony Parsons' remains would have ever been recovered. And they were recovered, Bethan, in that peat bog.
And oh my gosh,
his family were able to lay him to rest.
That's just something that just makes me feel like that smallest bit of relief for the family, because I just totally assumed that he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And that's something. Well done, Caroline. What an incredible woman.
Absolutely. That was all down to Caroline. Incredibly, incredibly brave. She knows what this man is capable of as well.
Yeah, that is also so brave. Yeah, you're potentially putting yourself at risk because you're asking him more questions. What if one day he decides, no, I've told you too much?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, yeah. And she said that, you know, he clearly had, I don't know if necessarily he had a drinking problem, but she later said that he would change into a completely different person when he'd been drinking. I don't know exactly what sort of person he would change into, but potentially, I guess, one that was volatile and one that she couldn't second guess, so that there would have been a danger for Caroline. So it was incredibly brave of her to do this. And the police absolutely took her seriously, and they began to excavate the site on the 30th of December in 2020. During the dig, investigators initially discovered a segment of red material which matched the jacket Tony Parsons had been wearing when he disappeared. And between, this was painstaking, between the 13th and 14th of January, so this is two odd weeks in, they finally exposed Tony Parsons' body. And with great care, they were able to recover his body and remove it. Tony Parsons was found to have suffered catastrophic rib, pelvic and spinal fractures following the collision. The rib injuries were considered to be the most immediate cause of his death due to the effect they would have had on his breathing. It was possible that Tony may have also suffered from a collapsed lung as a result of the fractured ribs. It was later established that even if the brothers had immediately sought medical help, due to the remoteness of the location, it would have arrived too late to save Tony. But they didn't know that. They didn't know how long it was going to take for emergency services to respond. So they willingly left him to die there when, for all they knew, they could have done the right thing and saved his life. And they certainly didn't administer any first aid or anything.
And like, you shouldn't move somebody, but even if they'd have like bundled him to the back of the car and driven as quick as they could to some sort of hospital, you probably would have done more damage and that would have been really bad. But if you've been thinking it's going to take too long for emergency services to get here, then potentially that's an option.
Yeah.
But they didn't even think to do that. They literally, the first thought was, we need to cover our tracks. Let's move, let's change vehicles and get rid of our phones. That was what they were thinking of. They were immediately, we've been drinking, cover our tracks. Cowardly way out, which has actually ended up being the worst option possible.
And it was quite a prolonged, continued investigation from the discovery of Tony's body in January 2021. And it would actually take until December 2021 until the McKellars were charged in connection with Tony's disappearance. And initially they were charged with murder. However, that charge was later amended. Eventually, they both pled guilty to defeating the ends of justice, and Alexander pled guilty to culpable homicide. Brian McConaughey KC, the defence lawyer for Alexander McKellar, told the court that his client wanted to apologise for the trauma that he caused to Mr. Parsons' relatives. So there was perhaps some genuine remorse. We don't know if it was genuine, but some remorse was shown on Alexander's part at this time. But yeah, it's too little too late, and I'm not sure I really believe it, considering everything that had happened.
I don't know. I think that there probably was real remorse, because to be suffering mentally that much with panic attacks and side of things, and to have some sort of drink problem, which, like you said, it's not been definitively stated, but to be a very different person when you're drinking, and to be drink driving as almost something that's not out of the ordinary, it sounds like, from the fact that that was just how they went home. I think that there probably was some real remorse, but it's not, it does nothing to make me feel any sort of sympathy for him or any sort of care for him. I just do think that there probably was some real remorse, and actually there would have been some sort of relief when everything was out in the open. Yeah, you've got a really shit time ahead of you and you're about to face trial, but I think there probably was some sort of element of unburdening of this secret he'd been holding on to for so long.
I think that's fair, yeah, because they didn't set out to kill somebody. You know, Alexander was ultimately culpable for this, but they didn't, yeah, he didn't set out to do that. So, yeah, I think that is fair to say that there was probably some genuine remorse, but he could have undone a lot of the damage had he handed himself in pretty quickly. Yeah, and he would have caused untold torment to Tony Parsons' family for over 3 years. Alexander's KC said, "He is not an evil man. He acknowledges that he has done a terrible thing which has caused untold distress to the Parsons family. He would do anything he could to alter the decisions he took in September 2017, but he cannot rewind the clock." John Scullion KC, defending Robert McKellar, said that he had misplaced loyalty towards his brother in trying to cover up the death. Mr. Scullion said he bitterly regrets his callous and cowardly actions, and ultimately Alexander was sentenced to 12 years in prison and his brother Robert to 5 years and 3 months. And just, you know, interesting really that we're visiting that concept of twins again, and here we don't have Folly or Duh, which we've previously looked at. We have this misplaced loyalty, this real tight bond between twin brothers who live together, work together, socialise together, and now are intertwined in covering up the crime of one of the other brothers, you know, of one another. So it's interesting, you would probably have that sense of loyalty, twins or not twins, but yeah, I just thought it probably adds another dimension to what Robert did and why he helped his brother get away with this initially. So an incredibly tragic case. It's really, really sad. And yeah, our thoughts remain with Tony's family. At least they now have some answers and there is some closure, but it's just beyond tragic what happened. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another case. So we will see you then.
Bye.